Welcome to the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, where you'll get actionable tips and advice on major gifts, direct response fundraising, legacy giving, and much more from leading experts in the nonprofit sector. Now, here are your hosts of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, Andrew Olson and Roy Jones.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Andrew Olson, co-host of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast. I'm here with my good friend and colleague, Roy Jones, co-host of the Rainmaking Podcast. Roy, how are you?
Great to be here. It's going to be fun. I love talking to folks that have done university fundraising in the past, and this whole subject of emotional intelligence, I like getting into that. I'm excited to talk to Scott. I'll let you introduce him.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this as well. I think our listeners are in for a treat. So I have gotten to know Scott Kaskoski over the last, Scott, what's it been? 5 months, I think?
Yeah, actually a little more, maybe 8 or 9 months.
Okay, so 8 or 9, I can't count. Scott is a great guy. He's the senior performance mentor and partner at a firm called Bright Dot. And in Scott's background, before coming to Bright Dot, he led all the philanthropic strategy and execution at Morris Animal Foundation. And then he's held major gift roles at University of Denver, Temple University, and UT Chattanooga. So some great sector experience. And I have just really enjoyed getting to know you, Scott. I mean, you got a great personal story and temperament in the way you approach fund development. And I'm really excited to have you on today to talk to our listeners about how you and your firm approach philanthropy, because I think it's, a lot of people consult in this space, and a lot of people talk about, how to fix fundraising, how to coach fundraisers, but so many of them focus on the tactics. And I love that you guys get so far above that and really deal with some of the root issues. So I'm excited to talk about that with you. Before I do that, I just want to turn the mic over to you and ask for you to tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Andrew, thanks. Roy, thanks. And Andrew, to your introduction, you wrote down almost everything I said for you to say about me, which is, is great.
So you can pay me later.
Check is in the mail to your favorite charity. But I really do appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I am a fan of yours, and I'm a fan of this podcast. It is on my queue, and I'm really enjoying learning from you and from the guests that you bring on, and hopefully I'll be able to add a little bit of that today. As you mentioned, I've got a story that's my own. I grew up in a very, very humble Western Pennsylvania background. I needed the grace of God and a lot of help from a lot of people to be even able to access a higher education. It was made clear to me at age 13 what my future could look like if I didn't work hard and take on a lot of that onus by myself. But I was able to earn a scholarship. I was able to squeeze every penny out of that scholarship, and I was able to be a first-generation college graduate, and I'm really proud to have blazed a trail now for my family and my siblings followed. From that, I was able to start a career in university fund, small private liberal arts, major research universities. I learned about relationship-based fundraising. I was very lucky to be a part of significant campaigns, significant building projects, and develop significant relationships with presidents, chancellors, boards, dynamic coaches, faculty. And then I had my midlife crisis. I think we all get one.
Only one?
we all get at least one. How about that?
I'll give you that.
But I woke up on my 35th birthday and realized that I was burning out, and I was asking myself a lot of hard questions about the kind of work that I was doing in a university environment. For all that had given me, was it now starting to take from me? And I made a list of things I wanted to do if indeed my life was half over. And one of those things I wanted to do was transition into the nonprofit sector. 23 days later, I landed at Morris Animal Foundation as director of major and planned giving, elevated roles there a couple of times, and had a wonderful ride as essentially the philanthropy director at the world's largest and oldest animal health nonprofit. Got to know wonderful trustees, got to work with wonderful folks like Betty White. Yes, the Betty White, and others who helped elevate the brand of that organization. And through that experience, I had the opportunity to meet Dr. Bill Crouch in the basement of the Sheraton in Chicago at a conference where
that
he
sounds
was
swanky.
Yeah, yep. Not to sound too seedy, but we met in the basement of a hotel. He was representing Jerry Panis's fundraising firm, where he was Jerry's COO. And I had just started a boutique consulting firm with my dear friend Dan Reed in Denver called Seed. And Bill and I put minds together, hearts together. One thing led to another. I was moving east anyway to be closer to family and relocating back to Pittsburgh, where I live now. Bill and I decided that we were going to leave our firms respectively and start what was Crouch & Associates. Crouch & Associates launched September 30th, 2015. On January 1st, 2019, we became Bright Dot. Crouch & Associates was a firm that told you who we are. Bright Dot is a firm that tells us who you are, is at least the way we're putting the spin on it. But it's been a great ride. I'm learning a ton, and hopefully I've got something now to give back. My main motivation from getting out of client-side service and doing consulting and coaching was that I thought it was time to serve the profession and serve the sector rather than serving one singular organization.
I think that's a really cool mission calling. The reason why I was really excited to have you on and why I wanted to get you on this show as quick as possible goes back to something that you shared with me a few months ago. I can't remember where we were, but you said that the majority of instances where you're called in to help a nonprofit improve their fundraising, so whether they had a down year or they're just looking to grow or whatever it was, that oftentimes they are looking to you to provide whatever the next shiny object is or the set of tactics and tools, but you end up ultimately engaging with them around issues of culture and relationships and leadership more so than anything else. So I'd love for you to tell us about that and just give us a little context for what that means in our sector.
We came up with something that we call the circle of consequences. And the circle of consequences is born out of the reality that, as you said it, every single time we've been called into a nonprofit organization, higher ed, ministry, advocacy-driven, cult, doesn't matter. Every time we've brought in, we've heard some version, as have you, Andrew, of we've got to raise more money. And that's ultimately one of the deliverables. But what we find is that it's not about the money. We've never found a genuine and true lack of capital to be what's holding back the organization. Rather, it's always something else. It's the messaging. It's the stewardship approach. It is how you tell the fundraising story, how you illustrate the why of the organization. We are big Simon Sinek believers, and we teach the why. We're all certified why trainers at our firm. But it's never actually about the lack of availability of money. And one of the things that is always prevalent in organizations that struggle, we found, is culture. Specifically, what is the emotional intelligence quotient or factor of folks that are touching the fundraising process? When we started Crouch & Associates, one of the things we promised ourselves was that we were going to go out of business and declare ourselves a failure if we could not stir the culture of organizations we worked with. We decided that every client was going to hear something they haven't heard before, feel something they hadn't felt before, and do something that they haven't done before. And that's culture. Where fundraisers struggle and where organizations struggle is because there is genuinely gaps and a lack of resilience, perseverance, assertiveness, objective judgment, pace and independence, manageability, and those things that all kind of cobble together to form what we call development wisdom. Others call it emotional intelligence. That's the street name for it. We tried some other kind of variations on that. But we keep coming back to this concept of development wisdom and saying, you know what, that's the secret sauce. That's the missing ingredient where organizations and fundraisers are falling down and struggling and not achieving their full purpose. So how could we bring it, the science of development wisdom, rather than thinking that wisdom is something that you wait a long time to acquire, or that when your hair turns gray and white or becomes gone, you've acquired some modicum.
Hey, now, don't throw barbs at Roy.
You know what? I got to take the show. Balls on the tee, guys. I'm sorry. But I kid, Roy. But, how can we inject through our work this dose of development wisdom into shops rather than just hope and pray and wait for those things to happen? And so
they have to have the tactics right. But if you don't layer on this, what you are calling development wisdom, you know, what I've always called emotional intelligence, but the giving is an emotional act. It's not a transactional act. And that has to be learned and taught. And sometimes I find fundraisers, you know, maybe they're really good at sensing when to go in for the close or some kind of thing like that, but they're very poor at sensing when a donor is emotionally ready to engage in philanthropy. Talk to me about just how you get there and how you teach that. It's very different than the tactics or the techniques that we teach in fundraising most of the time.
We decided we would never be a firm that focused on hard skill development as our front page. And so while we do plenty of development tactical teaching and kind of authority and influence speaking into these nonprofits, we are continually guided by one of the great books out there. You've heard of Harvey Mackey and the Mackey MBA of Selling in the Real World. And Harvey asks in this book, what makes a super salesperson? The top three traits: hungry fighter, hungry fighter, hungry fighter. He lists 17 traits in this book of what makes a super salesperson. We've taken the book apart and we've basically rewritten it into a fundraising environment. Out of these 17 traits in this book, only one has to do with hard skills, content knowledge. You know what you're talking about. The others have to do with integrity, positive attitude, likability, good first impression, service mentality, great listener, thirst for self-improvement, things like that. So how do we teach it? The first thing we did is create a proprietary emotional intelligence assessment for the nonprofit world. It's the only one that exists. It's called the Profile XT. The first two hires we made at our firm were developmental psychologists, gentlemen. And we took an existing sales assessment, we recreated it, went through two rounds of beta, thousands of testers, and came out of it with a profile of 1,200 top performing fundraisers who had closed seven-figure gifts in the last 12 months at a cross-section of 190 institutions in this country. And we looked at the things that this profile group of 1,200 top performing fundraisers have in common in terms of their resilience, their adaptability, their assertiveness, their pace, their decision-making, their thinking and learning styles, their interest patterns in terms of a people orientation, a creative and a service mentality versus a technical mentality or an administrative mentality. And we are the only firm out there that can show you literally a picture of what a top performer's emotional intelligence looks like. Mm. So everyone that we work with, everyone that we hire goes through this assessment process. And by the way, we've now got different versions of this assessment. So whether you're a major gift performer, whether you're an institutional CEO, whether you're a backline performer, or whether you're a board member or a governor of an organization, there's a version of this assessment for you. You go through this assessment and you are compared to the profile, in this case, of a major gift performer. And what we do is we have the ability through our curriculum to literally move you through a curriculum closer to top performance. Can we get you all of the way there all of the time? No, would never guarantee. But what we can do is give you exercises, repetitions, and practical real-world situations and challenges, we call them. So literally taking your learning into a donor situation to improve your emotional intelligence. We teach fundraisers how to be more adaptable, how to let things roll off their shoulders in a donor conversation, how to have better pace in donor situations, so on and so forth. That's why 60% of the organizations we worked with have reported that they've earned the single largest gift in their history since they've engaged with us. Hmm.
Yeah, it really is a conversation with donors, isn't it? You're listening for those emotive signals.
Every donor, Roy, we're convinced, is holding up this invisible piece of paper. It's a job description. They are looking for an organization that can engage with the donor through conversation, through being not subservient to a donor, not managing a donor, but literally with a donor. And being with a donor in conversation, to get to the point where you build the relationship through a venue of trust, to the point where you can challenge a donor to sacrificial generosity in a safe way. That's the secret sauce. 60% of fundraisers are subservient to the donor. 30% of fundraisers think that this business is all about managing a donor. But it's the fundraisers who understand how to be truly with a donor, meaning we're walking this donor through this proverbial forest that's dark. You know, we do this all day, every day. We practice this craft of fundraising. Donors don't have that many opportunities to practice being donors and to practice being philanthropic and in relationship with a fundraiser, right? So there's an element of leading the donor through that. So how do you get out 6 to 10 feet in front of a donor and kind of pull them through the forest, but at the same time, give the donor the real impression that your arm is around their shoulder and that you are with them, you're listening to them, you are vulnerable to them, you allow them to be vulnerable back at you. And through that process, which requires emotional intelligence, you can get the donor to a place where they feel confident and comfortable letting you honor and serve their why and living out their story through philanthropy to your organization. And that's what philanthropy is. It's a response from the heart, not the head.
Man, that's powerful. That's deep.
It's what we do.
So I'm gonna drop the grenade question in the room right now, and that is, this sounds to me like a highly introspective process. And what I know about many fundraisers is, I'll use the term "we" because I fit that category myself. We are tend to be people pleasers, right? And it's difficult to get people to be that introspective and to really let somebody else pick around what's inside, right? And show them where those challenges are. So talk to me about how this process helps fundraisers allow that level of vulnerability so that they can improve and what the biggest challenges are you guys face when you're dealing with an organization and people who are doing this.
Well, that's a great question. There's a lot of ways to answer that, and I'll touch on a couple of them in the interest of time. First is that, you know, one of the things we pride ourselves on is increasing the level of vocational conviction. Think about this industry as one in which 98% of those who participate in it fall into it from some other field, from some other craft. This is one of the most, in terms of number of people participating in the fundraising profession, it's probably got the least number of people who came up through a traditional path, right? There's a very scant gray look at what, if there even is a path, what that is, what good looks like in this field. And so that's a difficult enough challenge altogether, because you've got, for 100 different fundraisers, 100 different mindsets of what good fundraising is and could be. And that's a really tough baseline in which to start this practice of kind of developing vulnerability, personal connection. We remind fundraisers that, you know, it really is true that people give to people. It really is true that people don't give to causes. People don't give to institutions. People don't give to movements. People don't give to campaigns or thermometers, but they do give because they're asked. And they do give when they develop a sense that a fundraiser, as a representative of the organization, is listening, is asking the right questions, is showing their cards, is showing empathy, is introspective, doesn't have all the answers, is challenged, confused, and confounded in sometimes ways that donors are as well. But donor and fundraiser together can solve problems. And because we know that donors love to operate generally in a problem-solution continuum, and while donors can't solve every problem, donors like to solve somebody's problems if they can, if they are indeed philanthropic and charitable in mindset. And so it's a process. It is a process that has failure written all over it. And, you know, I'm not ashamed to say that we, through our assessment and through our teaching process and through a lot of these hard conversations with fundraisers, now have a number really glad that we were able to have the process that we did. You helped me determine that this was not the career for me. You helped me determine that I should not be working in this kind of a job, that I ultimately don't have, I can't get there. I can't be at a place where I can be with a donor. I was doing this for artificial reasons. And, you know, I certainly don't want to say that for as many people as we helped, we have also shown the light to, but there have been folks that have been a part of our been a part of our teaching that have said, thank God I went through this because I understand I'm not built for this.
Mm-hmm. I see so often we think that there's a misperception that it is the hard sales closer that you're looking for. You know, when I hear you saying things like, you know, be vulnerable to see vulnerability and to be able to connect with donors in an emotive way, it's so different than the misperception of the hard charging sales closer, somebody that's just out there pitching. But yet I think you're right. It is that the people that can do that, you know, are in the top 10% of our industry. I like to say, you know, people that get it understand that emotion is the donor's love potion. I mean, if you want a donor to fall in love with you, with your charity, or the cause you're supporting, it's the emotion that holds that relationship together.
You know, I'm always reminded of the movie Glengarry Glen Ross, in which Alec Baldwin played, for those of you who don't know, he plays the sales manager, and he gives a speech to the sales team, and he says, you know, the only, and I don't want to misquote, but I think he says, only one thing counts in this world, and that's getting them to sign on the line that which is dotted. You know, the reality is that when the fundraiser manages the donor, the relationship centers on the fundraiser's goals. The question becomes, how can I convince the donor to give me an amount that achieves my goal? Bad things happen after that. Hurried asks. Relationships that aren't about helping the donor support work that aligns with their passion. It's about the organization's bottom line, right? You know, the old phrase, you've got to sit next to the cow if you want to milk the cow. Hard to milk the cow by sending a cow a letter or calling the cow on the phone. The other phrase, you know, you can't just make pickles. You've got to let the cucumber marinate. And that requires patience. It requires trust, two-way trust. Trust by the donor in the fundraiser's commitment to the relationship. Trust by the fundraiser in that the donor is interested in kind of living this philanthropic story and expressing it through the vessel of the organization as the indispensable fulfiller of the donor's why. It requires that trust, genuine trust. That trust brings about vulnerability, the willingness to challenge each other, not just the fundraiser challenging a donor, but a donor challenging a fundraiser towards a heightened level of generosity in conversation. Vulnerability is really intimidating. It's intimidating to be vulnerable personally, let alone professionally. But when a fundraiser and a donor can stand shoulder to shoulder and see in each other a shared commitment to impacting the world through the organization, that takes time. It doesn't happen on the fiscal cycle timeline. The best time for a major gift is when the donor's ready to make a major gift.
That's right.
So, Scott, you said something that I want to go back to, and I'm curious. The answer very well may be no. But I'm curious to know if in your work, you've ever had a client ask you to help them apply this kind of thinking and methodology below their major gift program to their annual fund, and how the techniques and the approach that you guys take, has it been tested in that space at all?
So it has been tested and implemented to the extent that we do fundraising communications, we do messaging work, MarCom work, storytelling and appeal writing for clients. And what we're helping clients to do, and this may or may not answer the question fully, but what we're helping clients do is learn to speak the language of the donor rather than the language of the organization. Organizations are really good about speaking the language of the organization, but there's a different vernacular, even at a, let's call it core giving level and into mid-level giving, there's a different vernacular that donors can use. And so We're taking appeals. You know, we just got through the year-end giving season. Regardless of when this podcast airs, we're here live on January 8th. We just got through the year-end giving season, and we took a bunch of appeals and kind of flipped them on their heads and say, okay, how could we write these in a more emotionally aware way? How could we even on paper to the majority of your file? How can we write this in a way that breathes new life, fresh air, and a different perspective into saying roughly the same thing? How can we say it from looking over here inward instead of in here outward? And so that's where we've, I think, taken some good baby steps in terms of that segment or that area of an organization.
Okay, cool. Thank you. You brought it up. You said year end. I was planning to bring it up.
I knew it was coming.
And you're right. We're recording this on January 8th. It'll air in a week or two. But, you know, Roy and I were talking about this before you came on briefly. You know, I've talked to about 24 nonprofits in the last couple of weeks. And international relief, domestic, you know, poverty alleviation, healthcare, kind of the whole spectrum. And what I'm hearing is a lot of concern, some hair on fire type responses. And just about everybody I'm speaking to saying that they had a really tough December. I'd love to hear what you're hearing in the conversations you're having and if you have a point of view on what happened in December.
Somebody asked, that's a great question, Andrew and Roy. Somebody asked me today, how was your holiday break? And I said, what break? You know, because if the phone wasn't ringing, you know, with clients, you know, asking what's going on and has the Postal Service stopped working through this government shutdown, then it was me looking at dashboards and trying very late in the year to manipulate some strategy and to help our client group, you know, leveraged to the best that they could the year-end giving season. I'm looking here at a dashboard of our clients and their Q4 performance, and it's not all in yet as of this airing on January 8th. You know, we know that stuff continues to trickle in, but I'm looking at a 20 to 30, if not a little bit more percent year-over-year downscale from the year prior. And it's not just your group of 24 or so, Andrew. It's and I don't think it's just my group and our group as a firm. I think it is a probably a sector-wide conversation. I don't know yet whether it's something that is one of those it is what it is things, or whether we can specifically provide the causation to this. But I would share this first. We are living in such a political and a social moment in this country. No matter what your politics, we are living in turbulent times. It's hard to find an area of the nonprofit sector in which politically, socially, you know, civically, and otherwise, that our times have not been affected. And whoever wished that may we live in interesting times, you know, I think we are. But, you know, we are seeing campaign contributions to the 2018 federal midterm elections, even down to a state and municipal level, be as high as a four-year presidential election year. There was as we all know, a ton of energy put into the midterm elections, a ton of money put into the midterms elections. We've never had congressional races and senatorial and gubernatorial races in a non-presidential election year where they were nine-figure races. We've never had $100 million congressional races in a midterm year. So we know that donor dollars are going there. The economy, despite what we hear about jobs numbers and employment figures, we know that the Dow lost its entire 2018 and finished the year in a very tumultuous position financially, where we are down 5.6% and down the S&P. And the mistake a lot of fundraisers and organizations make is thinking that just because a donor's portfolio is doing well, there is instant liquidity to follow. And that's not the case. You know, gains don't necessarily mean money. And so we are seeing skittish donors and hearing from skittish donors who just don't know the state of the market. We've never had Fed chairmen who are providing commentary about the state of the market and their own position like we have before, and that's impacting things. And then thirdly, we are, I think, starting to see some of the front pages of the 2017 tax legislation. We are, you know, we now know that donors, particularly in the mid-level segment, which is where we predicted a year ago that the greatest vulnerability was going to occur in terms of tax legislation, we're seeing the bundling happen. And donors are putting the onus on nonprofit organizations to try to make 2 or 3 years of philanthropy kind of stretch and work. I just got off the phone with a client in Southern California who said, you know, I've probably had a half a dozen donors, major donors that I could count on year over year, come to me and say that they were going to bundle, and only a couple of them did it this year. And I can't guarantee, and they can't guarantee that they would bundle in the future when it's quote unquote our turn to get the gift. It's their intent, but you never know what's going to happen in the market. Right. So
there's a big difference between holding money back and saving it for next year and then actually stroking a bigger check next year.
There's a huge difference. And we've never lived in a time where 12 months, you know, 12 months feels like 12 years away.
So I'm going to put you in the hot seat again. What do you tell a nonprofit that's facing that, right? So that feels to me like seeing a light at the end of the tunnel and hearing the train engine behind it. what do you say to give some hope and some potentially some direction to nonprofits that are feeling that way?
Number one, this is a, for those of you of faith, it's a great time for prayer, you know, and certainly, you know, I have bowed my head before probably more tables at a Panera Bread than I have over the last, 5 or 6 months with our group of ministry-based nonprofits. But I would, in all seriousness, say continue to be consistent. Continue to take the high road, to do the right thing, and to focus on impacting lives through your mission. The mistake, or the temptation, the temptation that a lot of organizations have, particularly in times like this, is to think that program follows money. Boy, if we could only raise some money, we would be able to do this program. We'd be able to impact the lives in the way that we dream about doing. The reality is that money follows program. You know, back to the circle of consequences I mentioned, where the problem's not the money. The problem is everything around the money when it comes to fundraising. It's culture, it's messaging, it's program strategy and design. This is a great time to make sure that program strategy is tightened and the strategies and tactics behind delivery of the program are as efficient and effective as they could be. This is a great time to do a program audit. And from that, programmatic success and programmatic impact and your consistency in talking about and demonstrating the impact of your work, then you have the opportunity to fundraise. Something tactical that we're talking with a lot of clients about is many clients think that stewardship is when you do something after the gift that demonstrates the impact of that gift or the impact of the nonprofit. What we're telling them, what we're kind of doing a lot of training in these days is pre-fundraising stewardship. Stewardship that happens pre-investment on kind of the program side of the money follows program continuum. And so how are we demonstrating impacts of the nonprofit and impact of the gift prior to fundraising, rather than saying, great, you gave this $1,000 or $100, and let me tell you what we did with it, and let me tell you what we were able to do, as if it's some kind of thing that hides under the curtain, you know, behind the curtain until a gift is made. And so we're talking about kind of the placement and the relationship of stewardship in the kind of the relationship continuum. But other than that, our encouragement is stay consistent. This is a movement. These times are times that won't last. These times are times that eventually correct. And it's happened every time before. It'll happen every time again.
You know, that's interesting, Scott, because I do think that what we are seeing is not so much a downturn, but a correction. Mm-hmm. Of course, I won't put you guys in this category, but I do know one vice president of development that took great pride in seeing about a 30% spike a year ago in year-end giving. And, you know, what I have found, you know, my team has met with 187 donors face-to-face in 2018. I personally have met with 116 donors face-to-face. What I have found is many people made a larger gift in 2017 year in because they wanted to get that gift in before all these tax law changes started happening because they didn't know what impact it was going to have. And so we got a huge spike before the Trump tax code happened. And I really think a lot of it is just stabilization.
We got a lot of the same questions at the end of 2017 in our coaching was simply, if you are to a donor, if you are in the position to express philanthropy through a gift, you know, it's better that you would do it in times that are certain than in times that are uncertain.
Exactly.
So go ahead and do that. I think that correction and normalization are two of the words that we ought to your point, Roy, talk more and more about rather than recession, downturn, you know, coming back. Philanthropy is a process that is always normalizing. It's always evolving. And in terms of, for example, the prevalence of a donor advised fund 10 years ago versus the prioritization and the significance of DAFs today, it's huge, right? We can help nonprofits look. It may mean that giving changes. It doesn't mean that giving stops. It doesn't need to mean that giving stops. We may need to adapt and normalize and evolve, and we will do that.
Very good. I feel a little bit more encouraged after hearing that. I think, you know, so many people are still kind of on pins and needles waiting to see how the year fully ends when they've processed all their gifts. But I think those are some great insights, Scott. Really appreciate you being here today. We're just about at the end of our time. If people want to get in touch with you, if people want to talk with you about the assessment tool and how your Bright Dot firm might be able to help them, how do people reach you?
On the web at thebrightdot.com. Scott@thebrightdot.com is a great email for me. We'd be happy to help anybody. And Andrew, Roy, I want to thank you for the time. I love being around smarter people than myself, and so this was the highlight of my day.
Well, we'll try to find some for you. Thanks.
Yeah. I don't know who you're talking to. Yeah. I sure learned a lot. This was good stuff.
Yeah, this is really good stuff. Thank you again.
Man, powerful.
Great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Newport One. Newport One can make a difference in your fundraising. So that you can change the world, you can always reach us at podcast@newportone.com. Please take a moment to rate this episode on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. When you rate this episode, it will help more nonprofit leaders just like you to help find us and get the information that they need to raise more funds for their organization. Thanks again for listening today.